and conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we are joined for the hour by author and theologian Dr. Matthew Fox. He's the author of numerous books, and today we're going to be celebrating the solstice holiday, and we're going to be discussing creation spirituality, liberating gifts for the peoples of the earth. We'll also be discussing many of Matthew Fox's books, including his newest. So please stay with us today for a special solstice program on creation spirituality. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today on the program, we're joined for the hour by author and theologian Dr. Matthew Fox. And here is Peter to introduce him to you. Peter?
Matthew Fox holds a doctorate in spirituality from the Catholic Institute of Paris and has authored 32 books on spirituality and contemporary culture that have been translated into over 60 languages. Fox has devoted 45 years to developing and teaching the tradition of creation spirituality, and doing so has reinvented forms of education and worship. His work is inclusive of today's science and world spiritual traditions and has awakened millions to the much-neglected earth-based mystical traditions of the West. He has helped us to rediscover Hildegard of Bingen, Meister Eckhart, Thomas Aquinas, and among his books are The Original Blessing, The Coming of the Cosmic Christ. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you, Peter and Mickey. Good to be with you both.
It's great to have you back. I've been looking over your recent work. It's quite amazing. But this is a solstice show, so let's talk a little bit about the Western history of solstice or the anthropology of solstice and what that means in terms of Christ's Mass and Christmas. Give us a little background on that.
Okay. First, as a disclaimer, I have to tell you, I am born on the solstice. My birthday is December 21st, the shortest, darkest day of the year. So I just have to put that out front, you see. I'm a little biased in favor of the dark. But of course, for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, solstice time is the dark time of the year. And of course, we have these amazing monuments. For example, in Newgrange, you know, which is older than the Egyptian pyramids, there's this amazing monument where one day of the year, my birthday, December 21st, the sun shines down the shaft in this ritual space, which is very, very powerful. And of course, a lot of the pyramids in the Yucatan in Mexico, too, were oriented toward the solstice. So it's all part of really psyche and cosmos coming together. And that's what's important about the equinoxes and the solstices, to get us out of our narcissistic anthropocentrism and realize we're in this universe that's an awful lot bigger than us and upon which we're sort of dependent. And it's taken 13.8 billion years to get us here. So we need stories. We need big myths to remind us of our place. And of course, one of these stories in the Western tradition is Christmas. It was a deliberate act that the early Christians decided on the solstice as the time of Jesus' birth. They didn't know when he was born. And so the stories built around that are very mythological. For example, the wise men coming by way of a star and all that, you know, following the star. And even the message to the shepherds, you know, at the bottom of the totem pole of the time. You know, if you've ever been around shepherds, and I have, I lived in the Pays Basque for a while, you know, they smell like sheep because they live and dine and work with them. So, you know, they're not the most welcome people on the social pyramid. And so these stories that were built around the birth of Jesus, this is not history, but they're powerful myths, obviously. And the idea that the four-legged ones were there, which is really borrowed from Isaiah 1, that the ox, Isaiah 1 says, my people have not known me, but the ox and the donkey know me. Well, the early Christians put that into this mythological story about the Christ. And the Christ is a reminder that divinity is not some old guy in a white beard, some old white guy in a white beard, but divinity shows up as a child, too, as a puer, as a child in all of us. That's the mystic in all of us. So there's a lot of stuff going on archetypally in this story, both of solstice and the sun coming at the dark time of the year, and in the story of the Christ also. And the early Christians weren't dumb. They realized a dominant religion was celebrating the solstice. This is a deep part of the pagan religion. So a lot was going on there.
So, Matthew Fox, what you're pointing out, certainly, you know, a lot of people understand what you just said, but some people, particularly people that may be adherents to a particular religion, in this case Christianity, certainly in the United States for a number of years, there's been sort of these cries about a so-called war on Christmas and these kind of things, which I suppose could be dismissed for people that, you know, understand more deeply what it means. But how do you address some of the things, how do you address some of these kinds of things that we see in our society, where it seems that people that claim to be adherents to a particular faith don't understand the history of it? And if they don't understand the history of it, might we suspect that maybe they're missing part of a message somewhere or part of that mythological narrative that you talk about?
Indeed. I think fundamentalism, by definition, is not looking for new questions or new answers. They've got it all locked up in a box. It's anti-intellectual in the saddest sense of that word. I would say the real war on Christmas is turning it into a capitalist orgy. The whole consumer addiction, which of course drives our economic system, that's the war on Christmas. Jesus wasn't about going shopping beginning the day after Thanksgiving. I mean, that just wasn't his message, you know? The guy was pretty earthbound, and he took the side of the Anawim, of those without a voice and without power in the culture, not the side of the consumer industry, if you will, or class. So that's the real war on Christmas. And these shouts coming from fundamentalists about a war on Christmas is, of course, missing the whole point, both of Christmas and of the real war that capitalism is waging by co-op what are teaching and turning it into an ideology to serve its purposes.
We hear these calls from Pharisees and fascists of all stripes. And it's not just in the U.S., but particularly, like you mentioned, the orgy of consumerism and so forth and the co-option of this kind of thing. It's definitely antithetical to, you know, the mythology, to the teachings that we get. And, of course, you can comment on this. You've certainly written so many books on this issue of that. Certainly one, the coming of the cosmic Christ. You're not just referring to quote-unquote Christianity in this sense. You're talking about a broad human spirituality.
Yes, I did a study in all the world's spiritual traditions, and I came up with 18 themes that are common to all. And one of the most important ones is the theme of light. I found that light is the nearest synonym to divinity around the world, in all the world religions. You know, the Buddha says, be a light unto yourself. And, of course, the Buddhists talk about enlightenment. And the Celtic traditions and the African traditions worship a god of light and of the sun. And so all this feeds into the theme in the season of solstice and of Christmas. And, of course, the Christ says, I'm the light of the world. Now, this is not Jesus talking. This is the Christ, meaning the Buddha nature or the Christ nature in all of us. We are all meant to be lights in the world and in times of darkness, whether that darkness be literal, like December 21st, or whether it be the kind of cultural, historic moment we're living through now with ISIS and Donald Trump and the other darknesses that are threatening to overwhelm us. So we all got to stand up and be counted and tap into that light that's in us. It's also what the Hindus talk about in Namaste. It's the divinity inside all of us. This past year, there's a marvelous book written by a rabbi, David Seidenberg, on the image of God in the history of Judaism. And he was searching for a theology, a Jewish theology for ecology. And he was able to conclude, going through the entire Hebrew Bible, the Midrash, the Kabbalah, all of it, he was able to conclude that the image of God is in every creature. Well, I told him that's exactly what the cosmic Christ teaching is about, that Christ is in every being, and that's the Buddha nature. So now we have three major religions that are saying the same thing, and it's an important thing that every creature bears the light of divinity, and we who are humans, we have to kind of work at it harder than other creatures. Thomas Merton, the Catholic monk, used to say every non-two-legged creature is a saint, and there's only humans that have to struggle at becoming who we are, and that's about tapping into that light that's in us and standing up and taking on the forces of darkness.
You talk a lot about creativity and the importance of that in cosmic nature of human beings and all beings, for that matter. And you call for a tsunami of creativity. also as a form of worship. So talk about creativity and then talk about your cosmic mass.
Well, you know, I think creativity is the only thing our species has going for us. It gets short shrift in education. Check it out. When there's a crisis, a money crisis, which there always is, out goes the theater department, out goes art and music and the rest. And every time a politician opens their mouth about education, all they talk about is technology, science, and math. They never mention art. They never mention creativity.
Well, they don't mention humanities. Just look at the root of that word.
There you go. And even though creativity is obviously essential to math and technology, too, but the point is we ignore that which most distinguishes us as a species and makes us so dangerous. Thomas Aquinas, 13th century, said, "One human being can do more evil than all the other creatures put together." It's astounding. This was 800 years before Stalin or Hitler or Pol Pot. He had this insight. Why? Because as a pre-modern thinker, he didn't undervalue our intellect or creativity. And the truth is that whether we use our creativity to create nuclear bombs or drones to kill innocent people with or Holocaust ovens, you know, our creativity is powerful. So we've got to be able to guide it and employ it. Now, as far as worship goes and ritual, look at Burning Man. You know, 60,000 people go out in August to the desert. Now, how rational is that? You see, creativity taps into the irrational. Think of Stonehenge, you know. What got these people out of their couches to turn off their TV sets to drag rocks that weighed thousands of pounds before the wheel was invented to set them up on a field? What drove them was their yearning for ritual to connect to the cosmos. All ritual is really about connecting psyche and cosmos and for humans to reconnect to the great mystery of our being. And that's why today when science is giving us a whole new creation story and a whole new grasp of the vastness and excitement of our cosmos, more than ever, we need rituals that allow us to tap in. So what I've been doing for 20 years is what we call the cosmic mass, which is to bring postmodern art forms such as rap and DJing and VJing, and of course, pre-modern prayer forms like dance. Native people all over the world dance their prayers. They don't bring books to prayer to a sweat lodge or to a sun dance. That's kind of weird. So that's what we're doing. We're bringing this postmodern and pre-modern language into liturgy. And we just had one last weekend at St. John's Episcopal Church in the Mission in San Francisco. And it was very beautiful because we're dancing together. We're not sitting on benches daring a preacher to keep us awake. It's an empowerment thing. And it's about engaging all the chakras. You know, most church, you're just there from the neck up. I think all the chakras need educating today. This is why we have an earth crisis, is because we're in our heads. We're out of touch with our lower chakras, which connect to Mother Earth. Also, our passion, our anger, the third chakra. We have to tap into that energy of our moral outrage to get anything done.
Matthew Fox, I'm hearing you railing against passivity, spectatorship, right? We don't want to be prostrate, just spectators, or we don't want to be sitting in uncomfortable wooden pews being talked at and then having rote responses. And again, that's the experience many people have. And when people think of spirituality, they sometimes conflate it with religion or organized religion, right? And many people have had various experiences with that. And what you're saying is obviously that this is all so much bigger than that and so much bigger than all of us. And you're saying, too, that we all have the ability to tap into this creative, powerful spirit in the universe.
We absolutely do, and we have to. You know, Thomas Merton, the Catholic monk, had an amazing observation. He died in 1968, but the big technological thing going in his time was getting to the moon. He died before we got there. But he said this. He said, "What good is it to fly around the universe?" He said, "Even ants can fly." He said, "If we cannot make the journey into our own selves, where the real struggle is going on." So I think this is really important. I mean, the human species is pretty messed up inside. How does something like ISIS achieve so much and scare so many and so forth? You know, we have to deal with our inner stuff. And the shortcut to dealing with it, as any native tradition knows, is ritual and worship. When you see really oppressed people survive, such as descendants of slavery or the Jewish people, you realize worship is at the heart of their survival. Ritual is at the heart of their survival because it's there that you tap into the ancestors, to the community that's already passed, but also into the morphic resonance, into the memory, the living memory of not only the ancestors, but of the visions they left behind. And real worship, real ritual, I think, is bringing all the artists together from a community, all the creative juices to awaken all of us. And this can happen in things like dance. It is empowerment. It is participation.
We're speaking with theologian Dr. Matthew Fox. We're talking right now a little bit about creation spirituality. We're also talking about the solstice and belated happy birthday to Matthew Fox, whose birthday is actually on the solstice. And we're celebrating here at Project Censored our fifth year anniversary. So we're celebrating 5 years on the air here at Pacifica Radio. So it's a lot of celebrating going on here today. And certainly glad to be here and carry on these kinds of conversations on Free Speech Radio.
I certainly think we're a cosmic radio show.
There you go.
Yes.
You got a new word for yourself.
Yes. We're going to go forward with that. So, Peter.
Matthew, talk about mysticism and the importance of that and what you mean by that and some of the practices and ideas that come along with that idea.
Well, I think we're all born mystics because we're all born with the capacity for awe and wonder. And I think that's the first stage of mysticism, is the being struck by awe. Unfortunately, our society, whether it's religion or education, rarely taps into that capacity of ours. I mean, it doesn't talk about it. There's a bias against mysticism in the modern consciousness. Ted Rosak, psychologist, used to say the Enlightenment held mysticism up for ridicule as the worst defense against science and reason. But really, mysticism is our right brain at work. Einstein called it intuition. And Einstein said there's no values without intuition. He says the intellect does not give us values. That's the left brain, of course. It gives us methods, he said, but not values. So even a man like Einstein, a genius and certainly not an anti-intellectual by any means, he was at home talking about intuition and mysticism too. So I think the first stage of mysticism is the experience of awe and wonder, which, of course, ought to be happening daily to us. But the second is what the mystics call the via negativa, which is darkness, silence, letting go, and also the experience of grief and suffering. These are trips that we take deep into our hearts, and they're mystical experiences too. And both of those need to be honored, the via positiva, the experience of awe and wonder and the light of things, but also the silence. And then also the grief issues. And when you make those two journeys, then creativity comes alive. So that's the third stage that I talk about, the via creativa. Because to me, we have a formula here that the falling in love with life, the via positiva, plus the via negativa, it gives us creativity. This ignites the flames in us of creativity. Then the last stage of the mystical journey, I think, is that of justice and compassion, because, as we alluded to earlier, creativity in itself can go many ways. It can be about killing, tearing down rainforests faster, or it can be about developing alternative ways of living as neighbors and all the rest. So we have to give a direction to the creativity, and that's the direction of compassion and justice.
Matthew Fox, you have a new book coming out. It's a sequel to your best-selling The Coming of Cosmic Christ, called Stations of the Cosmic Christ, where you were talking about, from your previous book, the survival issues of our time. You also discuss in this new co-authored book the need for an awakening of our cosmic selves. Can you talk a little bit more about that awakening and what you're trying to get at more specifically in your newest release?
Yeah, we're working with two artists there. My co-author actually is Bishop Mark Antrus, Episcopal Bishop here in San Francisco. We're dealing with two artists. One is deceased, the M.C. Richards. When she died, she left me her seven clay tablets based on the I Am sayings of the Christ. I am the bread, I am the living light, I am the good shepherd, and so forth. And she's put these into a very marvelous set of clay tablets. And then a contemporary artist from El Salvador living in San Francisco, Ulrich Javier Limus, did the other nine stations. So what we want to do, and the Catholic and Episcopal traditions in the churches, you'll find Stations of the Cross, mm-hmm. 14 of them. We want to balance that with Stations of the Cosmic Christ, because Stations of the Cross represent 18 hours in Jesus' life, you know, a real bad day. He had a real
bad day. As a former altar boy, I remember waltzing around the church doing it with the incense
there
and
you
the
go.
Whole nine yards.
But it's so. It's,
but the Cosmic Christ is so much more fascinating and probably would have intrigued me much more
well,
as a teenager.
Well, I hope so. Yes, because 18 hours in one's life is one thing, and dreary hours at that. But the Cosmic Christ includes, well, the archetype we've been talking about today, Christmas and the Nativity. It includes the Transfiguration, which was an amazing moment of three of Jesus' disciples kind of seeing his radiance at the top of a mountain. It includes Pentecost and Resurrection and all these other themes. It includes his marvelous teaching in Matthew 25 about when you do it to the least, you do it to me. Treating others as the Christ, you see, especially those who are wounded and needing, who are hungry and in prison and so forth, as Jesus spells out in that story. So there's so much more of his teaching and of the archetypal mythical stories around Jesus in the Cosmic Christ tradition than there is in just the Stations of the Cross. So we're trying to kickstart a movement that will get Christians and others out of our, what should I say, our boxes and alive again. There is so much in the Jesus story and teaching that's absolutely revolutionary and hasn't been tapped into yet. I think a lot of it was co-opted when Christianity took over the empire in the 4th century, and there have been exceptions along the way, but as a movement, I think Christianity needs a real big shaking up.
And part of your history includes a book called The Pope's War, where Benedict, you have a personal history with Benedict, Pope Benedict, that goes back to you literally being censored. Tell us a bit about that history and what happened. And what are the battles inside the Catholic Church, the core of Christianity, certainly carrying that forward?
Well, yes, I was silenced for a year under John Paul II, who had hired Ratzinger to run the Congregation of Doctrine of Faith, which used to be called the Holy Inquisition. And the two of them restarted the Inquisition. There's just no question about it. History will record this, because I'm just one of 106 theologians who were silenced or abused or expelled or actually had nervous breakdowns or heart attacks because of the way we were abused by those two papacies. And it went on for 34 years. Those guys were in a long time. That's a long time. It's a couple generations. So it was a very anti-intellectual time from the point of view of the Vatican. It was also the time, of course, of the pedophile priest crisis. And it was Ratzinger's office that was responsible for wayward priests.
But and Ratzinger became Pope.
And then he became Pope Benedict XVI.
Okay.
Instead of going after these wayward priests and dangerous men, they went after theologians. And it was our job, it's the theologian's job to think. That's our job. And they didn't want any thinking, and that's why they shut me up and also other very public theologians in Brazil, like Leonardo Boff, liberation theologian there, and the most read Catholic theologian in Europe, Eugene Drewemann, a psychologist priest. He was also silenced. So the three of us were silenced the very same year. It was a very political act, a warning to other theologians to get in line and quit thinking. So that was the heart of it. Then several years later, I was expelled from the Dominican Order, which I'd been a member 34 years. And that was by Ratzinger also, when he was still head of the Inquisition. So it's a sad story. And now what's interesting about this new Pope, Francis, is that he is stepping on the toes of these neocon Catholics, as you said earlier. And that's why there's a lot of backlash to what he's proposing. His agenda is far more thoughtful and respectful of theologians. For example, the first liberation theologian, he has invited to the Vatican twice for dinner. So that's a statement in itself. He's also canonizing Archbishop Romero, who was murdered, of course, in El Salvador by the neocons there. He was persona non grata at the Vatican under John Paul II and Ratzinger. They despised him, and they asked him, why are you taking on the military in El Salvador, etc.? But here, this pope's going to make him a saint. So there's a flip going on in the Catholic Church, but not without backlash, especially right-wing cardinals in America. You see, one of the things, the strategies, was not only to silence theologians, but to make new bishops and cardinals that were very right-wing who were Opus Dei. And here in the Bay Area, we have an Opus Dei bishop of San Francisco today. In Los Angeles, the largest diocese in North America, has an Opus Dei bishop. And these people, I have a whole chapter on Opus Dei in my book, The Pope's War. These people are very fascist. The founder was a card-carrying Spanish fascist priest from the 30s. So, you know, there's this big battle going on in the Catholic Church. It's really under-recognized, I think, in the press, to tell you the truth.
Absolutely. And when the Pope was here, when Pope Francis was here, Antonin Scalia, Supreme Court, pretty high-profile public official that's also Catholic, refused to meet with him. I mean, those snubbings are more than symbolic.
Exactly.
But the thing with Francis, and by the way, I know some on the left or progressive end of the political spectrum have obviously, at least in part, embraced the newness, the different direction, the flipping of the direction under Francis. I don't want that to sound like that excuses the oppression of the institution overall, the treatment of women in the Catholic Church and so forth. I mean, that's still an issue. However, it's quite interesting to see a pope that actually walks the walk, right? The footsteps of the cosmic Christ, when rather than going and having dinner with dignitaries, he goes to the soup kitchen and feeds the homeless. And I was just reading an article, I'm sure you know more about it than I do, that the pope sneaks out of the Vatican at night to feed homeless people.
Yeah, he's doing a lot that's good, but I have to say,
Ratzinger wouldn't do that.
Those of us in California, for 6 months I fought side by side with Native Americans here in California about his effort to canonize Sarah. Mm-hmm. It was a horrible thing he's done. It's the worst thing he's done in his papacy, and it will be a mark on him forever because Sarah was not a saint. Sarah created death camps that we call the missions, and there's absolute proof of this now. It's in lots of books and careful research. So that was a huge error on his part, but it just proves popes are human too and make mistakes, sometimes big ones. But as a whole, this pope is a big improvement. But the word you use is very important, the system itself. You see, I come to the conclusion of my book, The Pope's War, that the reason there's been two schismatic popes in a row for 34 years, J.P. II and Benedict, is that the Holy Spirit wants to end the Catholic Church as we know it. I really think that's the case. I think we have to end the structure as we know it and begin anew with the real meaning of Jesus' teachings and story and the cosmic Christ archetypes and mythologies. And I think we're in a place to do that today. The scholars is such that we know where we stand pretty much. And we have to simplify religion. And this is not just something Christianity has to go through. I think all the religions of the world, Buddhism and Islam and Judaism too, have to strip down today. We can't afford, we don't have the luxury of wallowing in our incessant theological discourse in our heads or even in our ideologies. We have to start working on the really obvious issues of climate change and an economic system that will work for everyone, not just the humans, but for the four-legged ones and the oceans and the forests too, and the issue of women's rights and that balance. All this has to come about because time's running out for our species.
Matthew Fox, let's talk briefly. I'd like to hear your thoughts about this. What about people who are secular humanists, people who are atheists, but also want to change the world for the better, but they have different avenues by doing it? How do you address that? How does what you're saying potentially speak to them, or how can you speak in a way that they are more receptive to, maybe because they have, you know, sort of a block or an impediment because of the historic connection between the institutionalization and distortion of these principles?
I have a lot more in common, frankly, with atheists who have a conscience and morality than I do with Cardinal Ratzinger. There's no question about it. Morality supersedes, I think, ethics supersedes any particular organization or institution. And so we can agree, I, an atheist, on issues of justice and on science and the quest for intellectual finding and curiosity. And like I say, the story of the universe now that we have from science is a powerful story of creation. Aquinas said in the 13th century, a mistake about creation results in a mistake about God. To me, that translates to mean when science gives us an insight about creation, then we know more about how God operates. And we can deconstruct our projections on divinity. Also, in the theological and mystical tradition, there's the tradition of the apophatic divinity, and that's the divinity that we don't know about Eckhart says God is super essential darkness that has no name, it will never be given a name. A lot of atheism is, in fact, standing there in the apophatic space of not knowing, of not having words for what divinity is. We have to be very careful of our busy projections and stamping in God we trust on all our coins, dollars, and MX missiles. You know, there's such a danger in our abusing divinity that way. So I find I have a lot in common with atheists. And one thing I have in common is that atheism means etymologically no theism. I'm not a theist either. I don't think of God as being up in the sky someplace. For me, divinity is a presence. I'm a panentheist. We are in divinity, and divinity's in us, like water in the fish, and fish in the water. And that, to me, is the way I see the world. That's a mystical way of seeing the world.
We're speaking with best-selling author and theologian Dr. Matthew Fox. We will continue our Salsa special program after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today we're speaking with best-selling author and theologian Dr. Matthew Fox. His newest book is called The Making of a Post-Denominational Priest, and that was just released here this past month. Matthew Fox, tell us about that book.
Well, I originally wrote it 18 years ago, but there's been 18 years of experiences since, which I've included in this version, of course. But it's an autobiography. It's a memoir. I take up a lot of issues we've been talking about, of course, including my troubles with the previous Vatican. But it ends, actually, with the Pope's recent encyclical on climate change. And to tell you the truth, it's a good document, that is. And one of my students actually wrote a big chunk of it, Father Sean McDonough. He's a Irish priest who took my master's program here in Oakland on creation spirituality, and then afterwards he wrote a number of books on spirituality. He was a missionary in the Philippines, and of course the Philippines, there's a dire situation there in terms of ecology. I remember when I visited there years ago and I went swimming one day, and you went down and you saw these dead coral reefs. The Philippines used to have more coral than any place in the world, and now it's like a cemetery of these gray, ashen corals. So the Philippine people are quite alert to what's happening to their environment. And I think that very much impassioned Sean McDonough. And the Pope obviously read some of his stuff and invited him to write his encyclical for him. So it's a good piece of work, I think. And I think it's fun to have lived long enough. The two popes condemned me. In fact, Ratzinger said my work was devious and dangerous, quote unquote. But then here's a Pope who's hiring one of my students. So that's not bad. I like irony, and I like to live long enough to have seen both sides of the story.
You've lived this. It's amazing.
I've lived it.
You write about the sacrament of liberation. Hmm. And you also write about the art of education. And I kind of link those together because for you, education is really about bringing out the creativity.
It is, and I'm very fierce about the educational system in America today. You know, Einstein said, I abhor American education. And to that, I kind of say ditto, because I'm very unimpressed with our accrediting bodies that are made up of so many anal retentive bean counters. And, you know, I've wrestled with these people because I started my own university when I was expelled from Holy Names College, thanks to Pope Benedict XVI. And we had a marvelous run for 9 years, but I was going to these accrediting bodies and seeing what they could offer us. And they didn't ask a single intelligent question. And they didn't care about our content or our pedagogy. And the truth is, I had spent 30 years developing a pedagogy to bring the right brain into the classroom along with the left brain and bring the body with all the chakras, not just the head. And they weren't interested. They're interested in how many janitors you can hire and all this stuff.
And
I'm
recently,
sorry.
In the city, you saw the San Francisco City College debacle with the ACCJC,
exact
and
debacle.
They have finally got their comeuppance.
That's right.
And they're being, I hope they're not replaced and they just disappear because of exactly what you said. Peter and I are both also in education, and very much there's that trend, right?
Absolutely. I call it left brainitis. You know, it's a disease, and we're only educating a small percentage of the human mind. The human mind includes the right brain, and it includes all the body, all the chakras. You know, we learn from our heart. We learn from our guts, where our passion and our moral outrage is. We learn from dancing on the earth, the first chakra. So, again, this is why ritual itself has to be rejuvenated because traditionally, of course, our ancestors didn't teach their kids by forcing them to sit in a desk for 7 hours a day and then tell them they had a disease if they couldn't sit still. Our ancestors taught their kids through rituals.
Or drug them.
Yeah.
And that too. And then we drug them, our way. So, you know, there's so much that has to be shaken up about education at all levels today. It's a disaster. The Dalai Lama has said education is in crisis the world over. And he's absolutely right. And it's part of the problem. We're not going to, I think, reawaken our species without education cleaning its act up.
Mm-hmm. You write also how lust and chastity are virtues that are inside of all people. And it's part of the cosmic Christ. And sexuality is part of the cosmic Christ. And all forms of sexuality, including chastity. So elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, we're talking about the second chakra, aren't we, when we're talking about sexuality. And I take on St. Augustine, the 4th century theologian, who was very neurotic around sexuality. You know, he had an affair going for 13 years with a woman. They had a child. Then he became converted and took a vow of celibacy and, of course, turned his back entirely on his past. And unfortunately, he never grew from it. That is to say, he carried this regret about sexuality to his grave, and he lived to be, you know, in his 70s. And then he dumped this guilt on the next 16 centuries of Christians who came down the pike. For example, he says that sexuality has to be justified by having a baby. And that's the basis of all these popes saying you can't do birth control, even when the planet is dying from having plenty of human beings on it. He's saying no birth control. And then, of course, their views on homosexuality and everything, all based on Augustine. Jesus never talked about this stuff. And it didn't preoccupy the Jewish mind, but it sure did preoccupy Augustine. If anyone needed Freud, it was Augustine. Unfortunately, Freud came too late. So I take on Augustine. I don't think lust is a sin, you see. I think if you're happy to be alive, you should be grateful that your parents engaged in lust because that brought us here. So lust is a virtue in its appropriate context. I think we give lust a bad name. The same is true of anger. Augustine also talks about anger as this great sin. No, moral outrage is a very important fire in your belly that keeps you going. Aquinas said nothing great happens without anger. With anger, we persevere in the struggle. So obviously a powerful force like sexuality and lust can be abused, and then it's abused, though not because it's lust, but because it's a power trip. So obviously rape or abuse or infidelity to someone we've committed to, you know, those things are mistakes. But let's not give lust a bad name. I think lust, in fact, is a generic. Let's talk about eros. You know, eros is our passion for living. The late African-American poet from New York, Audre Lorde, wrote a brilliant essay on eros. And she says, I'm erotic when I write a poem, when I bake bread, when I make a table, or when I make love. Eros is the passion we bring to living. I think we need more eros, not less eros. And I think that's really what lust is the expression of our eros.
Matthew Fox, in a recent essay you wrote, it's Pope Francis's encyclical on the coming of age of creation spirituality. And you talk about how religion becomes irrelevant, dull, oppressive, and insipid, kind of just riffing on what you were just saying about the need for passion and embracing life. And I think you're talking in a passage here about railing against injustice. You write, religion is irrelevant when it ignores science and when it does not stand up against powers of injustice, whether they're corporate powers pillaging nature and destroying our climate, media powers peddling entertainment addictions and distractions, or religious bigotry masquerading as tradition in opposition to homosexuals or women and their rights. Can you comment more on some of those ideas?
Well, first, that language about insipid religion comes from Rabbi Heschel. He wrote just a brilliant essay about religion when he said we shouldn't blame the decline of religion on science. We should blame it on religion, he says, because it's become insipid, it's become boring, and so forth. And I praise him so much for that. I love Heschel, and he's a man who walked his talk. He wrote a big book on the prophets, which is a classic work. But then he marched with King in Selma and so forth, and he took a lot of flack for it from his Jewish community in the 60s. They said, you know, there's enough anti-Semitism in the world without you taking on segregation in the South as well. So he was a great soul and a great mind. There's a saying in the Middle Ages, corruptio optimi est pessima, the corruption of the best is the worst. When religion loses its anchor and its real reason for existing, it can become a very negative force, obviously. And, of course, we can see that in ISIS and so forth today. But you can see it in any fundamentalist movement, in any religion, that hijacks the basic inspiration of the charismatic leader around which religions tend to be born. And religions are always needing to be reformed. I mean, Buddha, after all, was trying to reform Hinduism and move beyond it, simplify it. That's the kind of time we're living in today. We have to simplify. That's why I say we have to shake it down and come to the essence. And that's spirituality. That's the inner work that has to be done and then projected into our institutions, our places of work and so forth, and education. So that's the task we have before us today.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about Thomas More's work, his book, A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. In a sense, he's sort of bringing people who are not part of religious institutions and saying, it's okay. It's healthy to build spirituality in your life, to think of a cosmic Christ, and to build your own religion internally, and how you operate in the world. Is that a creative way to go about this?
Well, I confess I haven't read that particular book by Thomas More, though I've read some of his other stuff, and I've met him. He's a former Benedictine, like I'm a former Dominican, and I have a lot of respect for him. He's a therapist, as you know. So it sounds like a book that's worth looking at. But yes, I talk about moving from religion to spirituality, but we don't want to over-psychologize this. Spirituality does take place in community. You were just telling me about the redwoods where you live and how their roots interact with one another so much. You know that authentic spirituality is not a private trip. You know, it is a communal trip, but it does put an emphasis on the individual's responsibility to take care of ourselves, you know, in terms of practices, finding practices that work for you. And, you know, we're three people sitting in a room, and you know, I may have practices that work for me, and you may have different practices that work for you. I myself have found great support in Native American practices, sun dances and vision quests and sweat lodges. I just find that tradition to be, obviously, first of all, it's earth-based, and that's so needed today. But it's also cosmic. The psyche and the cosmos come together in a sun dance, for example. And it's not dualistic. It's into the body. And so I just find a lot there that's just very practical in terms of grounding a prayer life and connecting the contemplative and the active. At the same time, I'm still within a Christian lineage as well. But I think we're living in this in-between time. You know, there's a sociologist at the University of California who's written about postmodernism, and he says, all of us today belong to so many communities at once that we should write ETC period after our names. I think that's really interesting. It's true. We're no longer in the boxes that our grandparents were in. And we're kind of out there floating around and bumping into walls and everything else. But we are trying to find practices that work. And practices are important because the human species, we have so much imagination and so many distractions that can easily, you know, kind of wander over the cliff if we don't kind of be alert. And that's why all the spiritual traditions talk about being on guard, about being warriors, about being alert, and not falling asleep on the job, you know.
Yeah, Matthew Fox, what you were just saying about Native Americans and these kind of practices, that certainly resonates with me. My father had the same kind of path from Catholicism to these, you know, these very tangible but still spiritual practices and so forth. And so definitely very, very powerful things. We're talking about all things spirituality, really, today with Matthew Fox. And Peter Phillips was asking a little bit about homosexuality and religion, and you didn't have a chance to really get into that in detail or address that. So could you go back to some of that now and back to another example of fundamentalism in institutionalized religion and how it's treating some of these things versus the approach of the cosmic Christ?
I think that the subject of homosexuality is a good example of what happens when religion ignores science. Again, Aquinas saying a mistake about creation was also a mistake about God. So if we don't listen to what science has learned about sexuality and its diversity, and that approximately 8% of any given human population anywhere on the planet is going to be gay or lesbian, and that science has counted 464 other species that have gay and lesbian populations, then we realize that, hey, this is a minority. It's not the majority. The majority are heterosexual, but it's an authentic minority. So it's not against nature, which has been the argument, if you will, or the shibboleth in religions of all kinds for centuries. So to me, this issue of homophobia, which is, of course, a big one that's dividing churches today, and in many ways is dividing African Christianity very starkly as well. And this is a topic that came up recently in Rome at the Vatican with the synod there, you see. The right wing is absolutely unmoving on the subject of homosexuality. The Pope is trying to open up a discussion, and he's having a lot of trouble doing it. But again, this is what happens. It's the same thing as the Galileo case 400 years ago, you see. The religion was stuck in its stories, but it didn't pay attention to what science was learning. Now, when Pope John Paul II, about 20 years ago, lifted the condemnation of Galileo, he said something like, well, this will never happen again. We'll listen more to science. Well, it has happened again, and that is around homosexuality. And the truth is, I don't know too many homosexuals who want to wait 400 more years to get approval from the Vatican about their identity and their lifestyle. So that's just one concrete example, I think, of where religion wanders off into its never-never land when it ignores science. And the consequences are real for people's lives, so it's a serious matter.
And of course, that goes back to that quote that I was riffing on earlier about religion becomes irrelevant, dull, oppressive, insipid. I mean, that's one tangible example of how it's turning away people who are spiritual beings and who have connection.
Absolutely. And one of the stories I tell around this is that a Native American taught me years ago that all the spiritual directors, the great chiefs in America, were gay. And there is acknowledgement in the native traditions before the Europeans came that gay people carry a special spiritual gift of spiritual leadership. And this is true not just in North America, but I've done my research and spoken with scholars of Africa, too. Even in Africa, this is the case. I know one scholar, African scholar, who has written a book on this, but he says, I can't publish it in my lifetime because I will be murdered for doing so. And it's true in the Celtic traditions as well. So it's not just about homophobia. It's about a community cutting itself off from some of its spiritual energy and leadership by being homophobic.
Matthew, talk about creation spirituality and the process of dying. What does that give us as an understanding of the meaning of death?
Well, of course, death is such an integral part of life. And it's an integral part of creation. What we now know from science about the universe is that stars themselves are born, they live, and they die. And they give gifts back as they die. There's a resurrection there, too. Not only stars, but galaxies. So everything in the universe lives, dies, and resurrects. So that's where what the Christians would call the Paschal mystery, the archetype of life, death, and resurrection, takes on a whole new meaning, I think, that we all disappear in the forms that we are now in, but that doesn't mean that some other expression of being does not go on. Meister Eckhart, the great 14th century mystic, says, when we die, life dies, but being goes on. And I think this is the teaching, you know, of all the world spiritual traditions, that life is not just about what we see, that there are other expressions. And we call this the communion of saints or the ancestors. And, of course, it's mystery. And yet, you know, one thing that I've learned over the years, listening to people's stories, is that while we talk about the resurrection of Jesus, for example, the truth is that I meet all kinds of people who have experiences of loved ones who've died who return to them after they die. I have a friend who is not religious at all. He's not anti-religion. He's just never gotten into religion. He says religion for him is like baseball teams. He's not interested in which team he's on. But he told me after his mother died, several months after his mother died, she showed up at the end of his bed, and they had a conversation. And she said to him, you know, remember the values I've taught you and all this. And every time he tells me this story, his eyes tear over. And it's just a beautiful story. He's a very down-to-earth guy. He's not New Age or anything. He's a blue-collar worker. And this happened to him. And I have met a lot of people for whom this has happened. So I think we're very closed-minded if we imagine that we know what happens after we die. But I think the key has always been, how do we live? Aquinas puts it beautifully. He says there are two resurrections in life. The first is waking up in this lifetime. And the second, you don't have to worry about if you've undergone the first. So it is about living fully in this lifetime, and that's eternal life. And that's the phrase theologically, and it doesn't cease. It takes on a different form.
Matthew Fox, earlier we were talking a little bit about sort of the history, the development of you know, more modern incarnations of Christmas in the West, so to speak, and certain definitely co-options of various pagan-type rituals, and many actually. If you go back and look at the time of Jesus particularly, which is what I want to kind of get to a little bit in this question, there's a lot of borrowing and sort of things coming through history, you know, mythologies and so forth that we see in various manifestations that, well, in some cases sprout out to be major religions, whether it's Judaism, Christianity, Islam, etc., even going back to the Egyptians, Horus, and so forth. I mean, similar creation myths and these kind of things. It's interesting how there's some repetition in so many of these stories over thousands of years. My specific question, though, is since you write about the cosmic Christ and like the concepts of this, what do you make of some of the recent theological research that is casting doubt on the existence of an actual historical Jesus as one person? These are some things that I've seen over the past couple years. I'm just curious as to your take on it. It doesn't seem like it matters much for your thesis or for a lot of the things that you've been saying, per se.
Well, the picture I have is like a bird with two wings. One wing is historical Jesus. Mm-hmm. The other wing is the cosmic Christ. The historical Jesus, I recognize, is a person who lived, and we know something, but not a whole lot, about his life. We know something of his teachings. And there are some very good studies on it. I really recommend the book Rabbi Jesus by Bruce Chilton. But the cosmic Christ is the archetype that was released. And this is, to me, this is historically grounded because Paul, the first writer in the Christian Bible, brings in a lot about the cosmic Christ. He says the Christ is that which holds everything together in the heavens and the earth. And he got that language somewhat from wisdom in the Hebrew Bible in his Jewish tradition. So again, it's not just that a person lived, but what fires did that person set? And the truth is that the fires that were set by Jesus and his story and his teachings turn out to be quite immense. And even today, they're very radical. They are about both social justice and contemplation. And they bring together the psychological journeys we're on, if you will, the personal interior work, but also the social work, the work of justice and compassion. So as you say, historians and biblical scholars can argue over the details about which of these words that we attribute to Jesus were really his words. Mm-hmm. And I think we've done the basic work on that, and actually it's roughly 15% of the words we attribute to Jesus were actually his words. Mm-hmm. But even those 15% tell us a lot about the man.
Well, this is kind of a forest for the trees issue, too, anyway. I mean, do you...
Exactly, yeah. Because as you say, it's not just a look in the past. Mm-hmm. It is, how is this breakthrough, if you will? For example, he summarizes so much of the wisdom of Israel. He was not all that original. He's speaking in the prophetic lineage of his Jewish ancestors about justice. He's boiling it down.
Quite profound and quite radical, and the manifestation of that message today is something that people, from Black Lives Matter to, you know, and Occupy, it's something that people thirst for, right? They thirst for
very
this.
Very radical, and of course, he did die at the hands of the empire. Now, that's mm-hmm. really saying something. The story is part, it's not just his what came out of his mouth, mm-hmm. but the story. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that very story about tragedy of a good person being murdered by the empire, that's an archetypal story that still goes on and it faces us today. You know, what forces are we willing to stand up to and speak out against? And how can we do it cleverly? Because he did it cleverly. He did it as an artist, you see. He did it as a storyteller, his parables. Though at times he confronted as well. But it's interesting that he chose the path of an artist, not the path of a theologian or a politician. So there's just a lot in that story. And then it's important today, of course, to put it up against the Buddha story and the other stories that we now have available. And how does each shed light on the other? And how does each complement the other? I had a dream years ago. When I was staying in a Buddhist home. And that night I had a dream about the Buddha and Jesus. Buddha lived to be about 84, and he died a serene death. And he had seen all of life. He'd been a father and a husband and a prince and all the rest, and a pauper and a teacher. Jesus got himself killed at 30. And I realized from the dream I was told that we need the serenity of the Buddha and the moral outrage of Jesus, of the prophets. So East meeting West, I think, is a time for the human race to grow up today, that it's not one or the other. We need both. Now, I'm not saying that Jesus was never serene. He went out to the mm-hmm. wilderness, out to the desert to be alone in contemplation. And I'm not saying the Buddha was never angry. He was at times. But the way we've taken them historically, the Buddha represents serenity and a long life, and Jesus represents a short life because he stood mm-hmm. and was counted. I think we need that dialectic. And I think we're at a time as a species where we can appreciate that we need that dialectic.
Dr. Matthew Fox, I think that's a fine note for us to end on. We thank you so much for your work over the decades, and thank you for coming back to the Project Censored Show and having this wonderful conversation with us around the solstice. And I also want to thank my co-host, Peter Phillips, for, you know, doing a lot of the work and the reading on your material and inviting you back to the program. So thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you, Mickey and Peter, for having a program like this where we can talk about things that count.
Censored material, to be sure.
Censored material, there we go.
Cosmic radio.
Cosmic radio.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
Well, that does it for today's program. You are tuned to Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer Anthony Fest and our engineer Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on over 25 stations around the United States. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time. We got the love of the brothers in-